Well, thank you for valiantly attempting that song anyway. It was a good effort. So a few weeks ago, we started the study of the book of Romans. We, I think, got through verse 17. And now we're ready to look at the last half. And the heading in my Bible says, Unbelief and Its Consequences. And as Art and John were talking about our culture that's decaying, it really connected with me, as this is what I've been pondering on. It's just a really dark picture.
Yes.
And I think if somehow we can observe this and realize the dire straits that our culture, our world is in, without becoming afraid, that's what I would like to cultivate this morning. But I think we need to be real about it, and we need to realize it and see it for what it is, that when a society turns their back on God, that God turns his back on the society. And it is a very real, it's a reality in our country and our world, especially the Western world, is just continually one step after another turning away from God. But let's not, it's easy for us to look out there and wring our hands and say things are terrible and we are very good, but that's not what I'd like us to do. While it is important to look outward and observe and be aware, see that the end of the world is coming, things are becoming more evil, it's also important to look inwardly and say, how has this affected me? Because culture does affect us in a very powerful way. And in some things, that's not bad. The fact that I'm wearing pants instead of a robe is cultural and not wrong in any way. I don't think so. But so many other parts of the culture do affect us. And so let's look at that. As the culture is collectively turning their back on God, let's be sure that that's not affecting us. Also, we need to be praying for the world around us. We're supposed to do that. We're supposed to be a salt and a light. Salt, and that is referring to a preserving influence. And if we look at the city of Sodom and Gomorrah, God said, if there's 10 people in there that are following after me, I'm going to preserve it. Because Abraham prayed, so there's two things that we should be looking at. We should be praying, and we need to be that salt. Let's be those few righteous. So I'd like to turn to Romans 1. I'm going to start reading in verse 18. And as we read through this, keep in mind the progression. This doesn't happen usually overnight, where an entire society turns their back on God. It's one step at a time, various areas. And then I would like to, after we read that, relate that to what I see in the world around us. And I would like to also invite your participation too, things that you see, because I think it is a very good parallel to what we see. You know, it was a picture of the Roman world then, and also a picture of us here in the United States as well and around the world. So Romans 1:18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Or another word for that is suppress the truth by unrighteousness. By doing unrighteousness, they're suppressing the truth. Because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. For even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks. But they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools, and exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man and of birds and four-footed animals and crawling creatures. Therefore God gave them over in the lusts of their hearts to impurity, so that their bodies would be dishonored among them. For they exchanged the truth of God for a lie, and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. For this reason, God that gave them over to degrading passions for their women exchanged the natural function for that which is unnatural. And in the same way also, men abandoned the natural function of the woman and burned in their desire toward one another, men with men, committing indecent acts and receiving in their own persons the due penalty of their error. And just as they did not see it fit to acknowledge God any longer, God gave them over to a depraved mind to do those things which are not proper, being filled with all unrighteousness, wickedness, greed, evil, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, malice. They are gossips. That gossips really stood out to me. All these bad things, no, I would never do. Gossip. Maybe I would. So let's think about that. God looks at that pretty seriously. Slanderers, haters of God, insolent, arrogant, boastful. Thank you, Titus. Inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, without understanding, untrustworthy, unloving, unmerciful, and although they knew the ordinance of God that those who practice such things are worthy of death, they did not only do the same, but also gave hearty approval to those who practice them. Isn't that just a sad, dark picture? And as we look at where did it begin? Near the beginning, Paul says they're suppressing the truth. And if you think back 100, 150 years ago, to me, the suppression of that obvious truth of the creation that God made, that anyone with a clear, open mind looks at this world can say there is a designer. And they began to suppress that truth. And to me, in many ways, that's the beginning of this progression. And I find it interesting. I was recently listening to a book by a man who was very much believed in evolution. I wasn't listening to it for that part, but that became evident as I listened to it. And over and over, he referred to design. Because looking at it from a science, he was very thoroughly scientific, and looking at our body's design from a scientific perspective, there's no other way to say it. Now, he would have said that that design happened by just nature trying over and over again. But there was no other way to describe what he saw than design. And he said that repeatedly. And I think taking an honest look at creation, there's no other way to see what God has made but design. But that is being suppressed and was being suppressed for the last 100, 150 years in this country. And also besides that, there's an imprint of God on our hearts. Within each of us, we know, if we're honest with ourselves, if we're open, that there is a God. And I think as we look at evolution in particular, what that takes away is if you look at us as just being animals, there's nothing right, there's nothing wrong. There's no submission to God because there is no God in evolution. Takes away personal accountability for our actions because all that is we're predisposed to do whatever we're going to do. And so we don't have to take responsibility for our actions because we are just genetically determined to do what we're going to do. It's nothing more than that. Any sense of right and wrong morality is gone because whatever makes us survive better, whatever gets me ahead, is right. And another key thing it is, I think it mentions in here about not being thankful. If there is no God to create us and to give us what we have, then there's no need for gratitude. And so we are a God unto ourselves, if that's what we believe. And it says, they knew better. They deliberately did this, even going against what they knew. So they're suppressing that truth. And then the next thing that happens is that God gives them over to impure hearts. When the truth is suppressed, our hearts become impure. And there's a lot of ways you could look at this, but I look at the Roaring Twenties as a time when impure hearts became the normal. Purity was not important. Maybe the actions were somewhat okay, but the hearts weren't, as how I would look at it. And another 40 years later, we have the 60s and the sexual revolution, where the people defiled their bodies, and it became acceptable for all kinds of things, divorce and all the sexual impurity that went with that. And another 40 years later, I would say, we're going through, want to call it the homosexual revolution, where that's becoming completely accepted and normal and okay and promoted even. Says he gave them over to degrading passions, and they received in their own persons the due penalty of their error. And that is so, so true. There's all kinds of statistics of the things that people who live that kind of lifestyle face. Gay men are 6 times more likely to attempt suicide, women twice as likely, much more likely to abuse drugs and alcohol by some studies. LGBT youth are 9 times more likely to do drugs. Many homeless people are gay, AIDS, cancer. And all these statistics come from an organization that promotes the acceptance of homosexuality in our culture. I don't know if they're telling the truth or not, but they're not painting a very pretty picture of it. And I would like to take a look at, what do Christians in a society like that do? As I look around, what I see conservative Christians do, they won't bake the cake. They're going to vote for people who support what they support. They try to get laws passed, and they get really excited about Supreme Court justices that are on their side. And they fight for their right to discriminate against homosexuals, and they look down on these people. 40% of LGBT youth say they've experienced actual physical violence because of where they are. I'd like to ask you the question, how should Christians relate? This is a real question. This is not something hypothetical. This is something we face, and we're going to more. I would like to really hear from you, because I'm really concerned about how we're responding to this. What should Christians do? What would Jesus do? Have to have the Spirit of Christ. What is the Spirit of Christ? I think you're on the right track, but what is the Spirit of Christ? How does he relate to what I would see as very broken and hurting people? That's many times there's wrong choices, but there's some pain that most of us have no idea about that drives these people to these sins. So what does the Spirit of Christ look like to people who have experience the level of hurt that's driven them to that sort of thing?
I think the Lord would look beyond the outside actions and look to minister to the heart and see life form there, and then the rest takes care of itself. It's when we focus on the external that we get big arguments and hurt people, and it doesn't help anything. That can drop it further away. But one question I had,
it's not specified necessarily, but I would have to think that people who don't make some sort of profession that homosexuality is wrong would probably not commit violence against homosexuals. Yeah, I'm not trying to say that all that was from Christians, but it certainly doesn't paint a good picture, I think. So, what if the rest of you didn't hear, Bruce said, is we need to minister to the heart first of all and put less focus on the outward actions. And once the heart is cared for and repentant, those actions will take care of themselves. I think that's very key, compassion. We must care. Ed?
One of the things that I think is largely missing in our world, our culture, is a genuine concern, a genuine love, which I would interpret as a sacrificial love, meaning there's nothing in it for me. That is something that blows people away. But when you say, hey, I'm doing this for you, they're right away trying to figure out, what are you trying to get out of this? Whatever it is, whether it's a business deal or a relationship, people are used to simply put something. Mm-hmm. When you come with a genuine desire to help someone and ask what they're not doing, it's just foreign to them. And think of Christ when he came. I mean, we were the ones that walked away from him. And he came to redeem us. Give his life for us. That is what we should be doing in our generation.
A genuine, selfless, Christ-like love is very winning to all kinds of people.
I was going to say, love the sinner but hate the sin. And not allowing somebody's choice or actions to block us from seeing a soul that's desperately in need of God.
Mm-hmm. And it does seem that God has a special level of punishment and consequences for those sort of sins, and they are very bad, and we can't ignore that at all. But we may never allow that to get in the way of our love for that person. Anna?
What Bruce was saying, practically, how would you apply that to minister to the heart, like in actions? If you meet somebody, what does that look like?
Bruce, the question is, how do we minister to the hearts of those sort of people?
Well, it's the Lord. It has to be the Spirit. And I can only use example in my life. We were in New Orleans one winter on a work trip, and we went down to Mardi Gras to minister Jesus to the people. And there was not one judgmental bone in my body. That whole night, we preached Jesus. And there was a lot of hurting people there, and I don't know how it was used. I know one guy came up and he was trying to force me to judge him, and I wouldn't do it. I just couldn't do it because I said, I don't know what your heart looks like, but God does. And I didn't do the work. All I can say is I didn't do the work, but the Lord did it. And I think probably the best place to start is to ask him how to do it, because he knows what everybody needs, and sometimes maybe somebody needs a little word of correction, but when all I can say is God just filled us up, a couple brothers over there, and flowed through us, and we could even talk to like prostitutes and a lady that had a ball, and there was not one judgmental bone in our bodies. We weren't there to tell them that they were evil and wrong, and they needed to correct, but we were there. It was just like life was flowing, and God was trying to show them that there's life that they're missing. So I don't have a solution other than God has to do the work. But so often when there's too much of us in us, that's when we start judging people and ourselves among ourselves, finding our righteousness from actions we're doing and things like that. But I don't know. That probably doesn't answer the question. But I don't have an answer. It's a God thing, and God has to fill you. Put that love in you, and the place to start is to that in God, that you can love that person, whoever that is that you're being called to minister to.
Yeah, I think the love and compassion is key, and there's not a formula, but when we really care, people will sense that. And I've found situations where those sort of people are looking for offense. They want us to judge them because that's what you see in the news. You know, Christians, conservative Christians, won't do whatever they should do, or whatever they want them to do, or they won't serve them, or they won't whatever. And I have a really, really hard time seeing that as the Christ-like way.
Just thinking about how do we relate to them and the question that Hannah asked and everything. All of our love for others starts from a position of complete belief in God. We can't really love others unless we truly believe he is who he said and that what he said works. I saw a film once. You get down to I think it's the Air and Space Museum. There's this film about early flight and stuff, and there's this one picture where a guy in a balloon, you know, they're exploring the West, and there's a guy in the balloon, and there's an explorer down in the creek or in the river, and he's going down the river for the first time, and the guy in the balloon sees Niagara Falls ahead, right? Huge falls. This guy in the canoe is going to go over and die. And he gets in there, and he's from a position of truth. He sees, you know, he sees something the other guy doesn't see. He says, man, you're in for it. And he begins to shout with his little horn and tell him, you know, there's a water, there's something, hey, you're going to die, you know, you got to get out of there. And there's no question about the truth he's communicating. There's a danger in our world because we equate love, loving somebody, with never making waves and with never telling them something that they don't like to hear, or never, you know, that's what our world has conditioned us. That's what love is. That's not, Jesus didn't love people that way. He made a lot of waves, and sometimes he said things that people really didn't like, and things that, you know, caused them to be very uncomfortable. And I think if we're going to truly love someone, there's two things. One, we first of all believe God so completely that we believe his message completely enough that we're willing to share it without varnishing it. So it doesn't varnish our message. That's the first thing. We can't love someone if we're not giving them the truth. If we see a waterfall ahead and they're going over and we really believe they're going to be in trouble, we better be telling them there's a waterfall ahead and you better get out of the water. You know, there has to be a measure of truth. You can't love somebody without telling the truth. And then the second thing is we need to care enough about them that we're not telling them to come over to our side of the shore or, this is, get out of the water. This is for your good, like Ed shared. I think those are the two foundations for which we can really love someone.
So we love them enough to share the truth and, to care. So I'll come to you next, Lee, but I have one question about that. So in our culture where, so I'm just using your example of the man in the balloon at 100 years ago, where the default was probably you trusted everyone. Many people in our culture today, they default to distrust. And if I'm in the balloon shouting, people say, he's crazy. And I think there is something, some way in which we have to first build a relationship for them to trust what we say, because our culture doesn't default to trust. And I don't know exactly what that looks like, but does that make any sense?
Yeah, I get that. And then so the question then would be, should we bother warning people who don't trust us or something? Maybe we shouldn't. I mean, I probably would lean toward that side, build the trust first, you know, and don't bother shouting. And yet I'm not sure that's totally right either. I think there's times for both. We just have to preach. Preaching the word is sort of like that message that goes out, you know, and where it falls, it grows. But you know, then the personal work is where you have that relationship, maybe, and maybe those two things are differently. I don't have the answer to that, but
it's difficult. It's not an easy question, Lee.
Yeah, just in thinking about Hannah's question and kind of building on what Leon said, I feel very strongly that it is really dependent on the spirit, our own attitude of heart as we're relating to that person. Do we truly realize what God has done in our hearts and lives? Do we see ourselves as a sinner that has been saved? And if we're sharing out of our own experience, that's going to be very powerful, because it's not going to be in a proud way. Like if we're coming across as though I have everything all figured out here, and you're the one in wrong, and you're my mission field, I'm here to help you, it's not going to go down well, it's not going to build trust. And then as we look at the example that Jesus left, he touched people right where they were. He showed them that he loved them. He often touched the issues that they were dealing with in a very practical way. So I think the example for us in that is, let's do what we can for that person. Maybe it is simply helping our neighbor with something that he needs to have done. Maybe it's feeding somebody that's hungry or clothing somebody that's hungry. Now, we don't see a lot of those situations in our culture here. We can find them, yes, but it's not something that we're going to run into every day. But there are very practical ways that we can touch people in a practical way, and that they won't be able to see any motivation on our part that we're doing this for ourselves or that we're looking to get anything out of it.
It comes from a place of humility, not that we're better than anyone, but that we're sharing.
About building a relationship,
you know, you said before that God has a handprint on people. And if what I'm saying connects with that handprint, I don't need the relationship. Mm-hmm.
That's true.
God will do the work. And God talks about a well and a river. You know, that river's just flowing, and if people receive, then they get the blessing. Mm-hmm. Now, there's other places where relationships and trust is built. I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but that's definitely not the only way, because when what I'm saying connects with the handprint of God on somebody's heart, I mean, I've seen a young man who was involved with his friends, and he had backslidden. And when he heard the sound, when he heard the word of truth, he stood up, and among all his friends, he said, "That's truth." And he fell down weeping, and he said, "I've been backslidden, and I've been joining in with all their." And it was like the word touched the handprint of God that was on him. And he rose up and he became an evangelist to all his friends. I mean, in a broken way.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a place for both. But it all has to be God, because I can get out my six methods on building trust and relationships, and it's all me, and there's it's failure. So.
Yes.
I love the woman in Luke 7. She came in. She was drawn to the Lord. And the Lord just sat there. He said, never said a word to her. And she broke this alabaster box and anointed him and wept over him. Is that me? So somehow, it was wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Christ came in that place. The whole place was filled with the presence of God. So I guess I love people like that. I've worked with people for years like
mm-hmm.
this. But there's a lovely thing when they smell something
mm-hmm.
of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't, that's not preaching. I do preach.
Mm-hmm.
That's not preaching.
Right.
That's just life in the spirit.
Amen.
And it pours this ointment out. And everyone's aware of it. I used to tell the guys that 50 years later, some woman was walking with her baby struggle, a coach, past this house. And the little boy said, every time I go by this house, there's a lovely smell. See, that's where Jesus broke that alabaster box. And so if that's happening in us, there's going to be an aroma of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
People that be wanting something of Christ. There is another side of this. Our daughter in Oregon, their church, there's some problems. Homeless people come in during the service, and some of the people are afraid for their children and they don't know what to do, and
mm-hmm.
there are issues involved. But the fact is that that woman attracts, I'm attracted to that lady in Luke 7. I never read that story without something happening in my spirit. So
mm-hmm.
I think that's the answer to these matters. Christ is there.
There's one key part of that story that I think about often, and this happened different times in Jesus' ministry. He was willing to sacrifice his reputation to help someone whose heart was turned toward God. No matter where that person was, if their heart was turned toward God, he was open toward them. And he took some hits for that, because people said, well, he's not for real. If he would know what this lady's like. And it was true. But her heart was turned toward God. And whenever someone's heart was turned toward God, no matter where they were, he was very kind and very gentle. He came down very hard on some people, very judgmentally on some people who said they were doing the right thing and weren't. But whenever someone, wherever they were, turned towards God, he was very gentle. And I think we should be like that. Well, we could probably talk all morning about this, but I'd like to get to the rest of the verses. The next step, and to me, this is the era that we are coming into. It's called a depraved mind.
Daryl,
yes.
I'm calling sure Hannah got her question answered. I appreciate when young people ask questions, so make sure we answered that precisely. Do you have more?
Yes, and yes. There is, I was trying to, like, the one situation I had in my head is just being there and having somebody trans or somebody who is.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe, and practically talking to them, how would you do that? So I think, yes, maybe there was an actual application.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, in essence.
One thing that I have found powerful in people, hurting people wherever they are, when you don't know what to say, listen. And
isn't it easier to connect with people that realize they're needed, they're sick of their sin, they're looking for something better?
Yes.
But it's those self-righteous ones that think they're right, that what they're doing is all right, and that you must accept their lifestyle and endorse it to be accepted. Mm-hmm. For them to accept you, you have to endorse your lifestyle. And that self-righteous approach, Jesus rejected all that at any level, the religious or whatever.
Yes, I agree. There was a young man came to the Effort of Bible School one year. As I recall, for some reason he wanted to be in there in the dining room with a hat on his head. And Moe said, no, we can't have this. And he said, yeah, I'm not taking it off. So the reason he wore a hat, I presume, is to stand out. He was making a point. Now, some of these trans and all this stuff are trying to make a point. And if you get on their point, they're not going to receive it no matter what. Because that's their program. And so it's hard to minister to somebody who is intentionally, openly carrying a gun at a riot to prove that he has the freedom to do this, and you say, well, it would just be cool if he didn't do this. So of course he's not going to hear that, because he's intentionally being obnoxious.
Yes, and I think there probably is a point to where there are certain people we may not be able to minister to, but there are many that we can.
That's right.
And to be discerning. But I think another thing is to be willing to listen. We maybe as Christians are too quick to speak and need some time, and that's also a powerful way to build a relationship, is to listen. John.
I hope I'm not going down a bunny trail, but you said at the outset, we are a salt and a light. Now when I think of salt preserves, but also adds flavor. And a light, you know, gets rid of darkness, and it also is healing. And neither of them are forceful. And it's because both of those connections, or the foundation of both of them, are not in themselves. And I think that's what Christianity is. It's not about us. We are just here plugged in or connected with a God of the universe that has given us this salt and has given us this flavor and has given us this switch. I never heard of a dark switch. It's always a light switch. And, you know, and light heals. It's the sun heals. And the only way that works is being connected with God.
Mm-hmm. It's not about us. I think if we come back to that, that's a pretty powerful principle. So a depraved mind. Anybody define that for me? What does that look like when our minds become dark? Our hearts become dark, actions, worse actions, and then our mind.
Maybe this is oversimplifying it, but it seems to me like in today's terms where we say they have no common sense, they have no ability to see truth, to understand, whatever the devil puts in their mind.
And I think Jesus said at one point how the children of this world are wiser than the children of God, because they focus all their energies on what matters here and now, and they might be a better business person, or they might make more money, or they might do whatever, because it's all about them. But I think when you get to this point, that's not true anymore. Even the things they're focused on, they can't even do well because they can't think clearly. Their mind becomes dark. And if you observe, let's go back 1,000 years or more, when Rome fell, there were many, many reasons for this, and I could go, I learned a new phrase a week ago, shoot that bunny. So I'm going to try to remember that. But anyway, if you think about the darkness that was in the church, it became very dark. What do we call 1,000 years of when nobody did anything smart? The dark ages. It was dark. Their minds were dark. Their hearts were dark. It was dark. Let's oversimplify that nobody did anything good, but it was, we call it, it's, yeah. And I think that is what happens. It's the end. They heartily approve of those who do evil. They invent new forms of evil. Does anybody look around in our culture and not think we're inventing new forms of evil? If you have any clue about the movies, the games, the culture, the art, the music that's going on around us, it's inventing new forms of evil and continually more evil. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. Now, this is up in a couple. This is in the earlier part of this section, but I think this is a big part of that. When your mind gets depraved, what is called wisdom is not. Paul told Timothy, he said, Timothy, guard what has been entrusted to you, avoiding worldly and empty chatter and the opposing arguments. I think some Christians could listen to that, worldly, empty arguing, chatter, even if it is about godly things. And the opposing arguments of what is falsely called knowledge, or the King James says science, which some have professed and thus gone astray from the faith. And by what are considered by most people the brightest minds today, except some pretty things that are incredibly... they're rejecting just fundamental principles of reality. And I don't want to go get too political here, but bear with me. Because this is so entwined in our politics, but people are not thinking clearly in government, in all the institutions around us. But I think it's particularly obvious in government. Principle, God made them male and female. We can't seem to wrap our minds around that as a culture. We don't even say that's not even right. The biblical family structure, it's being attacked. It was in the news this past week, you know, how the Black Lives Matter organization. Now, I am all in favor of people's lives mattering, everyone's lives mattering, but the organization just recently took this off their website, but this is what they said. And I double-checked this. It actually did say this about a week ago. We disrupt the Western prescribed nuclear family structure requirement by supporting each other as extended families and villages that collectively care for one another. That sounds all right. Especially our children, to the degree that mothers, parents, and children are comfortable. We're not thinking clearly. Simple morality, right and wrong. The value of human life is forgotten. People are saying that, you know, particular lives matter. But then, how do you reconcile that with the survival of the fittest? If you believe in evolution, then it shouldn't matter. Nobody's life matters. People aren't thinking clearly. What about unborn lives? Do they matter? Get this, 29% of black pregnancies end in abortion. The national average is 16%. It's bad enough. But in 2016, there were over 600,000 medical abortions. It was 19% of the deaths in America that year.
Some were actually promoting killing them after they're born.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. But lives matter. Let's. People aren't thinking. And then we're supposed to trust the science. Any reason people aren't trusting the science?
It's very dark.
And another part of this is a return to false religions. False religions are growing quickly in America. Buddhism, Islam, Hinduism, pagan religions, nature worship, worshiping the creature more than the creator. Just the stuff. This was written almost 2,000 years ago. And it seems like a prescription that we're just following.
As I'm looking at this and trying to process all this, it seems like this passage is written to the enlightened mind.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's not the darkened mind, it's the enlightened mind. Whether it's a Pharisee or somebody that just seen God in nature, they're still accountable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But how, like verse 17 says, the just shall live by faith. And you know, a lot of Jesus' harsh words were to
he often had soft, kind words, and they came to him.
Mm-hmm.
So, in what way? I have too much stuff going on.
There's a lot to process here.
In what way is he speaking in this to the religious person? I believe very much so, where we've turned from faith and we've turned to religion or the program. And sometimes we can actually, maybe you've heard the quote or the thought that churches, how many churches can keep functioning without God in them?
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
and that's a church that doesn't have faith anymore. I mean, mm-hmm. they have a program, they have religion, they have whatever, proud, pharisaical. I mean, so how would God like to speak to us? Because the reality is, one of the curses is gossip, and that's probably been a big one among conservative people.
Mm-hmm.
So, and some of these others have crept in as well, but they're a minority.
Mm-hmm.
But in what way have we been unfaithful by not walking with faith, by suppressing faith with other things? Like, in other words, in my mind, I've been trying to put this in shoe leather
mm-hmm.
here where I sit, and mm-hmm. and maybe that's your heart too. But yeah,
I don't know that I have a real clear answer. As I think of this, even those churches who have lost the Spirit of God and it's just a program, in some way acknowledge the principles of the Bible, I think, for the most part. And I don't think that even those people apply here. This is where all that is thrown out over time, gradually, and culturally. And to me, this is for us to understand what is happening. And of course, a warning not to ever begin this progression or to suppress the truth or anything. But to me, it's a picture of what is happening around us. And as they were here, you know, in the Roman Empire, this was very much a part. This was very real. It was very much a similar place in country and culture, government, all of that, as we are. And to me, it's to help us understand, less than a warning, maybe. I don't know. That's my first thought. Maybe you have more. Mm-hmm.
Total depravity.
Mm-hmm.
But how much is the progression started already in professing Christian churches? Like, we don't need to wait until it's like totally depraved
mm-hmm.
to blow the whistle.
Right.
How much is it starting in professing Christian churches already, and is it starting in my life? And if so, how would God have me to cut that thing off and turn back to a life of faith? If that makes sense. Like,
mm-hmm. Do you have any thoughts on that? How is it starting? Is it starting in churches? Our church, other churches?
In the book of the Acts, that last chapter before Romans,
mm-hmm.
This is what Paul says. He says, "Well spoke the Holy Ghost by Isaiah the prophet unto our fathers." Sorry, it wasn't Paul. I believe it. Was it Paul? Okay. "Well spoke the Holy Ghost by Isaiah the prophet unto our fathers, saying, Go unto this people," he's talking about the Lord's people, "hearing you shall hear and shall not understand, and seeing you shall see and not perceive. For the heart of this people is waxed gross, and their ears are dull of hearing, and their eyes have they closed, lest they should see with their eyes and hear with their ears, and understand with their hearts, and should be converted, and I should heal them. Be it known therefore unto you that the salvation of God is sent unto the Gentiles, and they will hear it." So here we have at least one instance, and it's all throughout the Scriptures, that the problem began with the Lord's people and continued on. I mean, would you say that today, I think we would say, we're living in the time of the judges, in a horrible, horrible situation, spiritually, in the church. And it's in utter chaos, and what's happening is an abomination to the Lord. But it's happening in hearts first, in a widespread manner.
Mm-hmm.
So I really believe that as the church goes, so goes the world and those outside. If the church is following God, as we say they were years ago when the pilgrims came to America because of their faith, and they honored God, and principles were established, and that the world followed, because that was the way it was. So, and standards were set. But if the people of God turn away from the Lord, and it happens very, very subtly, it happens in our hearts. It can happen in a moment. If we turn away from the Lord, then everything's going to go. There'll be no more walls anymore. And the enemy comes right in and causes ruin and devastation. And the world out there, they're the victims of this. So we're really the root cause. How we are, our relationship to the Lord is the key to the world out there.
Yeah, the influence can certainly go both ways. We can be a salt, and we can also absorb that influence. So I think it can be, I think you're right that it can certainly be both.
I was struck by verse 22 where it says, professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. And I had to think a lot of this, where they changed God into a pet, I'm going to call it. So they changed him into a lie, like something to serve their interests.
That's right.
And that's what started this whole progression. So they started at a place where they knew God, then they professed themselves to be wise, and then they turned God into a pet, something to serve their interest. And then all these other deceptions followed, and I thought, well, yeah, that's true, that happened in the world, but that could happen in the church today as well, in my life, you know, where I begin to profess myself as wise and think of myself as something, you know, important. Well, when that happens, then God becomes my servant. God becomes a something for me to use to accomplish them. And that's where it talks about them changing into the image made like under corruptible man. He's changed into something that can serve my interests. Mm-hmm. I've seen that done in modern churches.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true.
That, you know, and then I've seen the results of that where, oh, maybe they didn't go out and do all of these things, but there's some of that evidence there and some of the same type of instruction.
Progression begins.
So progression begins there with that thing of professing ourselves to be wise. I think we really have it together, and we really got this nailed down, and we're really going to kind of create this something.
So if anything, Bruce, what I would say is it's a warning not to begin for us, and also to help us understand what's happening. And I think what I would like to leave you with is that when God leaves a society, it's not because he doesn't love us. It's because they left him first. God cares a lot. And many times he doesn't even overtly punish a society. He just leaves them to the natural results of the choices that they've made. And society, civilization, decays. Think of a quote from a man at the historic plantation where the pilgrims came. They reenact that. He said, "The world was once a very fine place, and it just keeps getting worse and worse." And if they would have observed that hundreds of years ago, isn't it so much more true now? And I'm not trying to say all this to scare anyone, but let's be a light. Let's be that salt. Let's be the change that we want to see. And let's realize the blessing and surrender to God, because it really is a blessing. It's a protection to us. And don't buy into this idea that we need to find freedom from God and all his difficult rules, because it's not the way it is. It's a blessing. Adam.
I have heard your testimonies and encouragements, and I agree with some of them, especially with Brother Lee. One thing I would like to clarify and encourage
you all is this, that Jesus said very clear, I am leaving this world because I am not from this world. But the king of this world stays. And because of his love and care, he sent the Holy Spirit upon this world. And another part, he says, in the Ten Commandments, it says, you know, very clear, love to God with all your heart, with all your mind, with all your strength. So if we put those pieces together, and on the next one, Jesus said, go and preach and tell the world. All the world. Go to the last corners of the world. So, and also he asks and tells us, don't accumulate treasures on earth, because such and such, instead accumulate treasures in heaven.
Mm-hmm.
We as Christians, how can we accumulate the treasures in heaven? Of course, we as a family, parents, we try to do our best, to work hard, to save money, to build something so we can live a comfortable life for our family. So, but what about in the future, in heaven? How can we accumulate the treasures in heaven? My encouragement is, if we put in practice love to God with all your heart, with all your mind, with all your strength, so He will give us a vision, an incentive to prepare ourselves as Christians, not just in reading the Bible.
How is this connecting?
The Bible is very important. It's principle. Because that's the Word of God. That's the blueprint. That's the guide. That's the light. That's the sword.
But Adam, how is this connecting to what we're discussing?
You were talking about how can we be the how can we preach? How can we be an encouragement for the lost people?
Okay.
That's what I'm saying. How can you just? It's not just my thing is this, you know. It's not just important to know, just to read the Bible, to encourage somebody else, but also to learn what is in the Word, how it's in the Word. That way, it goes to the Brother Lee, so you can touch, you can talk, you can preach, and you can encourage a lost person in a different parts of the world, in a different way, different situations. You can approach to a prostitute, you can approach to a drug addict, you can approach to an alcoholic, you can approach to many different ways. But we have to learn, we have to prepare that way. How to approach those types of people. Not just reading the Bible, but also we have to learn how to be practiced.
Okay, thank you.